Welcome to the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society. Welcome to ITSP Magazine Podcast Radio. You're about to listen to an episode of Tech Done Different Podcast with Ted Harrington. Do you follow the pack or challenge the status quo? Join Ted as he explores how to succeed by going against conventional wisdom. You'll hear leaders in technology and security tell stories about how they achieve their success by doing things differently. Knowledge is power, now more than ever.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Tech Done Different. As always, I'm your host, Ted Harrington. And with me here today is our special guest, Deshaun Jackson, the Director of Cloud Ops and IT at Social Solutions. Deshaun, thanks for joining us, man.
Happy to be here, man. Been looking forward to it all week. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, me too. You know, when you and I were talking about where should we explore our conversation today? I mean, there's so many parts of your viewpoint and perspective that I'm interested in discussing, but you had this idea that really jumped out to me. And so I kind of want to start here. This idea of we need to crawl before we walk and walk before we run. And I don't want to do injustice to what you were talking about. So maybe you could share with our audience what you mean by that idea and sort of put it into context.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, I've been working in the information security space for about 10 years now. A portion of that was in the military, and then a portion of that was, out in the wild in the private sector. And you know, if I analyze my career, you look at those stages of information security, where the crawl is, you're figuring out technical change management processes, you're figuring out the basics for vulnerability scanning, escalations, maybe even defining a security team in the first place. And kind of moving through the walk phase where you're starting to have engagements with third parties. Maybe you have some, form of security standard or compliance standard like SOC 2, ISO, something along those lines, all the way up to run, which would be, kind of the domain of, threat hunting, working around the clock with, MDR partners and that sort of thing. Most of my background in the private sector has been in taking organizations from a crawl stage to a walk stage. I understand that your audience is primarily, information security folks, IT folks, maybe some cloud ops folks. So in terms of, the value that I could provide to your audience, it's probably mostly, in that area.
Cool. Yeah. I mean, it's such a powerful and beautiful way to simplify this idea of, maturity, right? And that's definitely one of the big terms that people are talking about now is security maturity and where is an organization, where should it be? And I like the way that you sort of, I guess, broke them into different strata. So in your experience, how is it that, and I know that this might even just be an informal designation and maybe not like, well, these are the criteria I look for, but when you think about how you made that separation between walk between crawl and walk, as we're talking about, how do you get at that? And how do you think about that? I mean, you certainly described, these are some of the things that happen at each stage, but let's say someone's listening to this and they're like, well, what stage am I at? How should they be thinking about where they are?
Yeah, it's a really good question. One that I should probably have an answer that I've thought of before.
off the cuff's the best.
Yeah, man, you got the real me. I suppose one way to describe it is, does the security organization operate as a part of the business? Right. So we have, a pretty common issue, in the entire information security industry where, we have, a tough time getting, security projects prioritized, over other, other business functions, sales things, marketing things, infrastructure projects and things of that nature. And I think a lot of that stems from security organizations lacking a full and holistic understanding on what the business is, right? Mm-hmm. So, if you break it down, every position that I've been in, I know that, you've had your own company and that sort of thing. So it's maybe a little bit of a different story for you, but, for many of us in the security realm, we work for people that know more about running businesses than we do, but I think a lot of security professionals can tend to forget that, right? You know, we become so absorbed in security tasks. And, you know, we approach businesses with this, you know, perspective of, you know, security projects should be prioritized and they're not. And we skip the step of really taking the stance of humility and asking the right questions to understand what the business actually does and how the business makes decisions. So I'd say, like, you know, a good indication of, you know, a security organization that's at the walk phase is the projects that you're doing actually help other departments and there's cross-departmental support. You know, you may not have, you know, the level of technical expertise and, you know, the size of a security team that you'd have at the run phase, but what you're doing makes sense and there are logical arguments for why things are prioritized.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. I mean, I definitely see it in our own company too. I see it in all of our customers as well, that distinction you're drawing. And it's an interesting way to think about it because, yeah, you're right. I certainly have the business viewpoint already. But yeah, thinking about how does the security initiative tie into what the business is trying to achieve? And that's one of the things that I definitely am constantly advocating about, why I think security is a business issue, why it's a leadership issue. So, what's the advice then for how do we do that? How do we actually equip someone whose profession is security and profession is not necessarily the business? They, of course, exist in a business, but that's not their chosen path. How do we help equip them to be able to think about the world and see it the way that you've just described?
Right. So in your book, you have a better version of this than the way that I typically describe it. So you've mentioned that, or you mentioned in your book Hackable that many organizations view security like insurance, right? You pay the fee and you pay that fee so that you don't have a data breach. You know, I historically have called that like church Sunday, right? You know, like you go to church, but you don't live the way that you live in church during the week, right? And you just kind of pay that price to not experience the hell of a data breach. Right. So I think that, you know, what we can do tactically as security folks is just literally go and approach these other department level leaders. You know, so say you're, you know, you're a VP level, understand what the other VPs in your company actually want. You know, a good way to, you know, approach that conversation is to, you know, I'm a pretty like deeply introverted person, so I like to be prepared. So, you know, the way that I go about doing this tactically is say I'm approaching a marketing, you know, VP or marketing director. I'll prepare and list, you know, here are the top three things that I think I do for this person, right? And you go approach them, have a conversation with them, and, you know, evaluate that perception against the reality of the situation. You know, I think a lot of people, one, really appreciate when security folks or technical folks in general just have the gumption to approach them and actually care about what other business functions are doing. And also are like very willing to, we all like to teach, right? So very, very willing to teach what their role is to other folks in the business. And as you start to develop that picture of like what the business actually cares about, we have this gift in security where security is very obviously a common thread that runs through everything in a business, right? So it should be very easy for us, once we have a picture of what the business actually cares about, to tie the initiatives that we have to something that they value. You know, and at the same time, build the reputation in the business of actually, you know, following through and delivering on whatever those metrics are that the other business functions care about.
I love this idea that you just touched upon around teaching. Certainly, I mean, that's one of the core values at our company is education. And I believe that the best way to learn something is to teach it. I mean, like, I think about, like, this is still crazy to me that I did this, but when I first started, you know, years and years ago, I was like, well, if I want to be able to learn all these security concepts, I should probably go give a talk at a conference. It's like, what? Like, that's how I'm going to go learn these ideas.
Yeah.
But it was, you know, it was for me a terrifying thing at first to do. And then I got up and like, hey, I served, like, no one killed me. There was no one sticking me with a, you know, pitchfork at the end. And yeah. I think that, you know, that's obviously an extreme example. I don't think people need to necessarily get up on stage to talk about something they don't yet know about. But this idea of teaching is really powerful that you bring up. And is what you're saying, I believe is what you're saying, and I agree with it if it's what you're saying, but I want to make sure I know what you're saying. is what you're saying that you believe that most security people are very motivated to try to teach things?
I definitely agree with that. You know, that wasn't necessarily what I was saying, but I do agree with that statement. You know, so, you know, we, if we break down what that is, right, I think we all agree with what you said, right? That sometimes when you want to learn something, or really anytime you want to learn something, the best way to do that is by teaching it. But why is that, right? You know, I think the reason is because many of us can do things, you know, like, for example, I love grappling, right? And there's like a, you know, say I want to execute a choke or a throw or something. Maybe I can do that and I can perform that thing just because I've seen it happen. But oftentimes when we're forced to teach something, we have to examine the philosophies behind what we're doing, right? And as you're sitting in front of the class trying to show that throw or teach someone how to, you know, how to prioritize, you know, vulnerability assessment results, you're forced to actually think about, well, how do I do this? And in that process, you improve and you learn. And I think, you know, because security people tend to be very curious and inquisitive and subscribe to the, you know, the principles of continuous development kind of by design, because it takes that to be a really successful security professional. I think as a byproduct, we're all in love with teaching.
I like how you just casually throw out that, like, yeah, I mean, in my spare time, I like to choke people and grapple them. And so I think everyone listening to this is like, yeah, I'm not going to mess with Deshaun. So
I'm not even good at it.
I'm good with it. Yeah. I'm not kidding. We just got to choke a few more people. And
yeah, man. Yeah.
Practice,
yeah.
Makes
or
perfect.
Teach. Yeah.
Yeah. Teach. Like, this is how you choke that person.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's great. So I love it. I love the idea of continuous learning. I totally agree with you. And so maybe you could give me some advice on this. So one of the things I'm doing with the book right now is I'm actually turning it into a course. So that the idea is I want to get all these insights that I've acquired over all these years. I want to get them into every format possible so that they can help people. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's the book itself. I have an audiobook coming out. The course is another way to do that. How do you think that people who are interested in continuous learning, which I agree with you, I think most security professionals are, how do you think that a course necessarily fits into that? And I started this question asking about, here's a thing I'm doing and I need advice about me, but it's really a bigger, broader question about how do we even approach continuous learning? Like from your experience, how are people learning? Is it through books? Is it through courses? Is it through attending conferences? What's the best?
Yeah. It's a really good question. And it's probably a little bit of a different answer for every person. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that I've really, really delved into over the last year or so is in paying very close attention to my habits, right? So, you know, I think for me, I love reading books, right? You know, I think like from like a return on investment perspective, there's no better investment than spending $10 on a book, $15 on a book, and just having a wealth of knowledge that it took some unfortunate soul many years to write. Right? Right. You know, it's a good trade-off. But I find in, you know, so maybe if I read 100 books, you know, I'll have like one idea that I remember from each book. Or if you ask me, you know, 5 years later, you know, what is in a book that I read, you know, 5 years ago, I'm probably not going to remember very much. And I think it's because we tend to only remember what's reinforced over time and through what we actually do. So for me, the best process is something like, you know, I read a book, I take a course, and I try and remember something that I can actually go and apply in the real world, whether that's in, you know, a conversation that I'm having with someone, if it's an idea, whether it's, you know, a real world application of a skill that I learned in a book. And, you know, when we examine our habits, I think that's the measurement of continuous development. So I guess the answer is it's kind of a balance, right? Of like, what is the input? How do you get the best ideas into your brain? And then how do you reinvest that, you know, that information in the real world with your habits?
Yeah. It's interesting the way that you just describe reading books is I have almost exactly the same experience. And I remember when I first identified that reading books was a way that I was going to pursue my own development. I remember, you know, you graduate college and you're like, I can do whatever the hell I want with my time now. And like, there's no one there saying, hey, you have to read this book by this date. And then you have to do this quiz. And so I don't know about for everybody, but for me, certainly there was that period where I was like, well, I'm not going to read any books because I don't want to read. I don't have to. I read books for like 15 years of my life already.
Right.
But then I remember when I was thinking about mentorship, like how do I find mentors? And you know, I was really fortunate to have mentors early in my career. But then I realized like, well, this is one person's experience. Does this person know everything? Probably not. And that's that for me was when I said, oh, I got to start reading books because that's a way of like getting mentorship from the elite experts in any domain on any topic that I want.
Yeah.
And I remember that when I first started reading them, it was like every paragraph, I'm like, oh, I got to go implement this idea. And it became almost overwhelming until I arrived at what you said, right? Which is like, all right, I got to at least accept that I'm probably not going to remember everything from each book, but if I can get an idea out of each book, then I'm good.
Yeah. I feel so guilty, like using this idea without remembering where it came from. But the quote was something like, when you read, it's like you're meditating with the mind of the smartest people that have ever lived, you know? So I think like, you know, if we look at reading as like time spent just absorbing ideas with our mind, just beaming information from the pages into our mind. Not everything needs to be captured, but if you just do that exercise like meditation, things happen to stick. And you know, you have smarter things to say in conversation and you know, you're better at examining problems. And you know, it's just, you know, it's like jogging, but for your brain, which I do a ton of.
Man, that's so powerful. I love it. Yeah. And thinking about it's almost like, jogging is a great metaphor for it too. It's almost like maybe also investing in your retirement accounts where it's like, hey, you know, these dollars I put in each paycheck doesn't feel like that much, but over an enough amount of time, the accumulation of all of that produces these exponential results. And it seems like that's what you're saying reading essentially does too.
Yeah. Yeah. And it, you know, I from like a professional perspective, I've spent a lot of time, you know, over the last few years, trying not to focus on the epic moments, and focus more on the small things that happen a ton of times. You know, I don't know if that's truly like indicative of just kind of American culture in general, but I feel like a lot of us are just fascinated with the, you know, the graduating college, the finishing a big project, the, you know, climb Kilimanjaro, you know, all these like big epic moments, which are cool. But, you know, I think sometimes we can kind of miss the forest for the trees when, you know, we're spending 99.9% of our time doing these small repetitive tasks where, like you said, if we invest in that, the compound interest of that is better habits and more success. And, you know, that tends to be where we can reap the most rewards.
That's, yeah, I agree with you. So what's an example for you of where you've done that and you focused on maybe something that would be perceived as smaller that you're doing more routinely, but has these dividends that pay?
Yeah. So, you know, I work for a software company. We make case management software for primarily for nonprofits. We do some public sector work. And, you know, we follow Agile. So typically with, you know, I've got a cloud ops team. So it's, you know, cloud ops, DevOps, corporate IT, automation, and security. So generally in an Agile company, those functions sit outside of that. And I think, you know, like I said, a few years ago, I started to see this problem of, from a professional perspective, you know, our teams were just focused on these epic moments. So, you know, what we found, you know, I read The Phoenix Project, which like, you know, that changed my life, like most tech people at some point. And we started to implement these just simple things, you know, daily standups, weekly tactical meetings, prioritized backlog of projects. And it's seemed, you know, seemed kind of boring at first. But what happened over time is like our retros became the best part of our week because we started making all these micro improvements to all these processes, having better conversations in stand up, doing them more efficiently. And sure, it takes 10 minutes, but that's 10 minutes every single day, keeps everyone on the same page. And when you step back and kind of detach from the team, you know, we found that we were doing way more work. People were learning more. People were, you know, unblocked on projects because they were able to get in, you know, get help in before they actually needed it, or you know, before they were actually interrupted, and that sort of thing. So, you know, for us, maybe that was a boring answer, apologies to the audience. But you know, Agile was the best thing for our team.
I don't think it could possibly be a boring answer if you said, I read this book, it changed my life, and here's what I did next. Yeah. Like, who's not sitting on the edge of their seat to hear that? Yeah. Some of the themes that I'm hearing you talk about today are the way that you, I'm not sure quite how to phrase this exactly, but it seems like you have this really good focus on like the precise habit-based, like the things that happen every day. That's a couple things that you've mentioned, and you're sort of drawing it in contrast from the big, huge achievements that, you know, take a very long time to achieve. Are you meaning to say that those are mutually exclusive, in that, like, you, if you're focused on how do you focus on those small things, like a daily stand-up or whatever, does that mean that you can't achieve some massive major thing, or is a change like that required in order to achieve a large long-term outcome?
Right. Yeah, good question. And no, I mean, epic moments are awesome. I mean, everyone likes the epic moments.
Sure.
And you know, it's not that they're mutually exclusive at all. I mean, I think habits are the vehicle that, you know, drive us to those moments. You know, and you know, what's the right way to explain it? It's something like habits are the strategy, and the epic moments are the markers on the road, right? You know, so the epic moments are showing you that you're doing the right thing, not the point of doing the right thing. Does that make sense at all?
Totally. Yeah. Cause I mean, we certainly can't achieve things that are different if our habits don't change, because if your habits aren't calibrated to achieve whatever the goal is, then it's a wish. It's not a goal.
Right.
And I mean, I've certainly seen that with some of the things that I've set out to achieve, which are big, like, you know, when I wanted to run a marathon, as an example, it's like, well, my fitness plan at that time was not aligned to being able to do something like that. So I had to change habits, and changing habits is hard, but eventually it sticks. And all of a sudden you've got this, like, I don't know, I hate the word framework, but I guess you do kind of have a framework that helps you build whatever towards you're building towards, right?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And I guess to bring it back to security, you know, I think a problem that we have in the industry, or a problem that a lot of folks have in the industry, is your retention, employee retention. And, you know, I think that a lot of that comes from the majority of the work that we're doing not being meaningful. So maybe where those two things tie together is, you know, sure, we all like the big epic moments, right? We like, you know, being able to tell our boss that we cleaned up 90% of the vulnerabilities in production, or, you know, like, those things are cool. And I think the downside is that it kind of leads to a roller coaster effect, right? Where, you know, when you're in the middle of one of those epic moments, you feel great. But then when you're not, you don't feel great. So I think, you know, if we have a good map where we can tie our actual small day-to-day 99% of the time habits to those big epic moments, it puts meaning, you know, in the hands of our day. It gives meaning to the things that we're doing throughout our day, right? Which I think helps kind of stabilize that roller coaster.
Yeah. Yeah. There's definitely a job satisfaction element to what you're saying too, right? If you feel like, hey, this thing I'm doing each day is working towards my goal, that's going to feel way better than I'm doing this thing each day, and then I can't wait until I have time to work on my
right.
goals.
Yeah.
So
then
it's
church Sunday or insurance.
I love it. Yeah. Church, by the way, the church Sunday thing is really good.
Yeah.
So how does someone, okay, so let's game this out. Cause we sometimes run into this where, in our organization, we're very goal oriented. I mean, like any companies, I don't mean to say
right.
like that's somehow special, but like we each, the executive, the leadership team will set a vision, and then the department heads will set goals to support that. And then each individual sets goals in furtherance of the department goals. But something, this weird thing happens sometimes where people who are given full autonomy to set their own goals sometimes set goals that they then later feel like, well, that doesn't tie to what I do every day. And yet there was the full autonomy to choose whatever
right.
the goals they wanted to, as long as you're going towards this, you know, like, this is the end zone, work towards that, choose the play that you want to get there. In your experience, how have you seen people be able to better align those things, like the goal you're trying to achieve and the habits you're going to do every day?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, and that's what a good manager does, right? You know, so as an individual contributor, you know, sometimes you'll understand the needs of the business. You'll understand what you want, but unless that connection is made between, you know, hey, what is it that I actually want out of my life? And what is it that the business needs, and tying those things together to create meaning? I think it's tough to create a goal that, you know, will be meaningful over a sustained period of time. And I think generally that's because people are just too close to the work, right? You know, like, it's not a negative thing or a knock at all, right? I mean, that's what a manager exists for. A manager exists to be able to view a team from a detached perspective, see the big picture, and get to know your employees, figure out what is it that they want out of life, understand the needs of the business, and then tie those needs to what they're doing. I mean, that's what a really good manager can do, and give people, you know, work to do that is actually meaningful and will be meaningful over a sustained period of time. And then be able to, from a detached perspective, analyze the objectives that exist along the way and remind them when those epic moments come up, hey, this happened because you did X, Y, and Z 3 months ago or every day for the last 3 months. You know, so I think that's to be expected when people are creating their own goals, you know, in a vacuum, just, you know, because I think that's just kind of human nature.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's great advice for sure. So it sounds like maybe you've been through that experience either yourself being the manager or being managed. Are there examples of where what you've just laid out worked really well or maybe didn't work really well?
Yeah. I've definitely screwed this up and I've definitely been the person that's created the goal that I thought was smart at the time. And it wound up not being the right thing to do. And, you know, and so I'm trying not to sound like a broken record, but in the past when I've created goals that have felt meaningful at the time, but later on they seem like a bad idea, it's because it's all epic moment and no habit, you know? You know, say I have a goal that I'm going to go and get a specific certification, or I'm going to, you know, upgrade an architectural component on a legacy, you know, application, something along those lines. But it's not tied to my day-to-day work. I've been in these situations where, you know, it's January and it seems like a great idea, but then we get to December and it's like, well, man, I've been doing my day job and I haven't had a chance to study for this cert or haven't had a chance to upgrade this architectural component. So, you know, I think, you know, when I have messed that up in the past, it's because I haven't tied what I've thought all objective, no path to the objective. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Totally. Yeah. Where it's like, I don't know, that marathon metaphor is probably a good one, but it's like, I'm going to run a race, but no discussion of like on day one, I will run two miles, you know? Yeah. That's a good point. I like it. And I guess to a certain extent, it requires repetition, right? You have to have gone through a process of setting goals for yourself over a certain number of years and then set goals for other people or help them set. And then eventually it's like, oh, okay, now I kind of get it. Cool. So as we wrap up here and we're coming to the close of our time, if you were to, you know, obviously we're doing this in podcast format, we're not in a room together, but if, you know, there's people in the room and, you were to look them in the eye and say, hey, like, here's the thing I want people to walk away with based on, you know, the things I've learned or experienced or I'm advocating for. What is the big thing that you'd like to make sure that our audience walks away with today?
Yeah. So I think, you know, if you want to do security right, understand your business and really respect the vehicle of the business, right? You know, while I'm a security professional, I absolutely agree that, you know, security projects, security funding is highly important and needs to happen. If there is no sales vehicle, the business doesn't exist. If there's no marketing vehicle, the business doesn't exist. Same with finance and other business functions. So I think, you know, approaching business leaders with that in mind and that dose of humility ultimately leads to far more success when it comes to, you know, building your reputation in the company, being someone that's in a position where you can sell these security ideas to the rest of the company, and ultimately making these things happen. Yeah, I'd say focus on the small stuff and the big stuff. We may have beat that horse to death, but you know, I think that's highly important. And you know, if I'm going to leave something with the audience, you know, it's kind of a soapbox topic for me, but you know, I think that imposter syndrome can be a huge detriment to organizations, you know, or the perception of imposter syndrome, right? Where, you know, I was kind of a poor kid. You know, I'm biracial. I, you know, kind of spent my early childhood with my mom and my later childhood with my dad. And, you know, those cultural contrasts really molded me as a person. So, you know, working in these corporate environments, you know, I've really struggled with the idea of like, you know, I'm not of this world. Right. And, you know, I think one thing that I wish I'd learned earlier, but it took me a little bit of time, is like, everybody's in that position. And you know, it's the unique perspectives that we bring to the table, that give us collective value as an organization. So if you're in that situation, don't be afraid to share your perspective, flex the muscles that you have from your individual life, because there's only one you, and there are improvements, you know, to be made that only you can make in the organization.
I feel you, man, on imposter syndrome. I think I'm so glad you brought that up, because I think that it's definitely a common theme in the industry. I see it with a lot of really talented security professionals, security researchers in particular, who will, you know, have really amazing insights to share. And the world needs those insights, but they right. hesitate to share them on a stage unless it's like the hottest, most groundbreaking O-Day in, you know, that's going to like change the world and it's going to be on the front page of some newspaper right. or whatever. And I do think that, I mean, obviously there's a lot of issues with that. Like, a lot of people don't like public speaking. Sometimes the research maybe is old. But I think the bigger thing is along these lines where people are worried, like, well, what if I get up there and someone starts poking holes in my ideas? That's not going right. to feel good. And I mean, I feel imposter syndrome myself all the time. Like, writing the book, I was like, is someone going to think I'm a fraud? I'm like, wait, no, I'm not a fraud. But is someone going to think that, you know, it's like, it's a natural thing. Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
So how do you think that people can overcome it?
I think it's a skill, and you just have to get out there and do it. You know, like one of the biggest things that I regret is, you know, I had an opportunity to join a special unit when I was in the Army. And I started to feel that my boss uses this example all the time, where, you know, if you're the feeling that you got when you were a kid and you were riding your bicycle a little too fast down the hill and you started to get scared, you got to move towards that feeling, you know. So I've always regretted feeling that and then not going and pursuing that opportunity. So I guess my advice is, when you feel that like you're in that situation, when you feel like you're just going a little bit, you know, too fast, just a little bit more than you're ready for, embrace that. Because that's like the boundary of learning. And the farther that you push that, the farther you'll see you're able to go.
Oh, that's awesome. Such a visceral, we've all had that experience, right? Yeah. Riding the bike too fast, like, or I was skiing the other day and I had that feeling too. I'm like, oh God, what am I doing right now? Kill myself. Yeah, I went through this process of understanding fear in the course of writing a book. And I would definitely recommend anybody who finds himself in that the bike's going too fast scenario to, you do a couple things. First, you write down what the fear is that you're worried about. And then you write down, well, how likely is it to happen? And then you write down, well, what's the worst case scenario if it does happen? Like, how bad is this? Do I die? Do I lose my profession? Do I lose my loved one? You know, like, actually write down worst case scenario, and then write down, what do you have to do to neutralize that or to minimize the risk? We're all ultimately risk professionals if we're in security. And just writing those few things down, all of a sudden you realize, like, oh, this thing's not that scary. I've named right. it. I've identified it. So like, the fear of public speaking that people have is, you know, I mean, there's obviously a psychosomatic part to it. Just viscerally, your body's like, no. Yep. But it's like, oh, I might get up there and say something bad. It's like, okay, well, you're pretty smart. Get up there and say something that you do know about, and then people will be glad to hear it. So yeah, that's great insight, man. I totally.
Yeah, it's. It's like the difference. I love that. It's being objective. It's like the difference between what ifs, and what ifs drive you crazy, yeah, versus like, what am I going to do about it? You know, which, mm-hmm, empower you. So yeah, I'm going to steal that.
Yeah, totally. I mean, one of my fears was, what if I write a bad book? And as soon as you write it down, it's like, well, the solution is write a good book. And then, I mean, that sounds like a little easier said than done, but it's right. Like, okay, well, now I know what I need to do. So now it's, how do you write a good book? What are the elements of a good book? What makes a book good? And that's way more actionable than the like, what if it's not good? You know?
Right.
And so yeah, that would definitely be, yeah, my advice to people for sure.
It was definitely not a bad book. I've got like 15 pages to finish your book. I left it in a barbershop. Bald guys go to barbershops too. So I'm probably gonna buy it again.
Oh, well, I'll have to send you a copy. We'll take care of that. Those 15 pages.
I like it.
Well, Deshaun, thank you so much for spending some time with us here today. I think you've imparted so much wisdom to the audience, to me personally too. I've gotten a lot out of it. So thanks for your time, man.
Yeah, thank you. It was a blast. Appreciate it.
And everybody else, if you want to learn more about the show or request to appear yourself, just go to tedharrington.com/podcast, and we'll catch you next time.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Tech Done Different podcast with Ted Harrington. If you learned something new and this conversation made you think, then share itspmagazine.com with your friends, family, and colleagues. If you represent a company and wish to associate your brand with our conversations, sponsor one or more of our podcast channels. We hope you will come back for more stories and follow us on our journey. You can always find us at the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and society.